Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. How'd you like that sound? That's my throat clearing sound that I do for the radio. I'll do it now without any music interfering with it. Whoop. I did that for 35 years. And then I found out after going to a voice specialist because one of my vocal cords got snipped during the heart operation last year, that is one of the exercises that professional doctors, voice doctors who treat opera singers and other people, give people to recover from trouble with their throats or their vocal cords. it's just a small tone, then a middle, low tone, medium tone, and a high tone. Ooh. So there I was. See, I was already like a New York hospital doctor, and I didn't even know it. But we all have our different roles to play in the world. And one role that I've been noticing, and maybe some of you have been noticing, is that Bill Cosby has been playing a role for most of his adult professional life. And the role is, have you been following what's happening with Bill Cosby? I think most people have. It's been front page news in the papers and I don't watch TV news, and I don't get my news off the internet. Usually I get it from the newspapers because I'm an old guy. But I do occasionally see some stuff on the net. Bill Cosby has been there have been accusations that have resurfaced about Mr. Cosby drugging, and I'm repeating things now which are accusations, not necessarily, reality, or that they haven't been proven in court. So these are all allegations. Nobody has ever really proved anything in court, and it's never been he's never admitted it or confessed to it. But many, many women, at least a dozen or more women, from what I can tell, have accused Bill Cosby for periods, mostly in the 80s, but then later on, too, apparently, of drugging and essentially sexually assaulting them, of drugging women and sexually assaulting women, and in a serial way, like a compulsive way. And then he apparently made a settlement with one of these women, a financial settlement. And but this keeps coming up, and the Times has brought it up because it has resurfaced. More women, or women who had been reluctant before to say anything, have suddenly decided to say something about it. And there are apparently, unless I've got the timeline wrong, apparently women who have, and it wasn't so long ago. But the main thing is about Bill Cosby is his persona, of course. Now, a lot of people may, if it's the first time they've ever heard about this, this is not new news. This is old news. This happened before, in the 80s and 90s, these accusations surfaced. But now they've resurfaced, and in spades, so to speak. There's a lot of them, a lot of them. And, of course, what was shocking and disappointing originally to some people, depending upon how, this is a tricky part. I mean, depending upon how many people, how much the audience needed him to be the lovable husband and dad. He had a hit TV show in the 80s, which I didn't watch, but people told me about it, and everybody I knew was watching it, where he played a lovable doctor and a lovable husband and a lovable family man and a lovable father. And he was just a wonderful guy, and it was called, I don't know what the show was called, but his name was Dr. Huxtable. The character was Dr. Huxtable on this show, Bill Cosby. And a lot of people remember him from these Jell-O commercials where he's cute with little kids and sweet with little kids. And then later on, Cosby, right up until the present moment, has been giving lectures for the last several years, or many years, to black men on how they should behave toward their families, towards women and towards children. And it turns out that if you believe this, of course, it has not been proven. So I guess I'm guilty of, you know, perpetuating rumors or whatever. It's not a court of law here. But if you believe this kind of thing, and a lot of people do believe it, he is a gigantic hypocrite. Cosby is a gigantic hypocrite because his persona, which I will get into later, the meaning of persona and why what a persona is, his persona was of, yes, the lovable father and the lovable husband and the man who treated everybody, women and children, you know, as best he could. When I was growing up, well, I shouldn't say that because I never did successfully grow up. But in the 50s, when I was chronologically young, and in the early 60s, when I was in my early in teens or preteens and teens, the man who had a show like this was an actor named Robert Young, and the show was called Father Knows Best. And he played, I think it was a character, I forget, and maybe called Bob Anderson. I forget the first name was Bob or not, but Jim Anderson. Jim Anderson. And Father Knows Best was one of the great hit shows. It was a perpetually long-running hit show, sitcom, that was all about families. And it was about this, this 9-to-5 guy who was an insurance agent downtown somewhere. And it all took place mostly in his house, this sort of small suburban house that he lived in. And he also, the character Jim Anderson, just like the character Dr. Huxtable in the Bill Cosby show, was the ideal father and husband. You know, he had his faults. He made mistakes. There were arguments. There were times when he got things wrong. But then it all turned out okay at the end of every show. And Everybody believed in that. I mean, in fact, they believed in it so much that that sometimes they would confuse. I mean, nobody ever called Bill Cosby Bill Huxtable. But a lot of people, including me, when I was referring to it the other day in an email I sent to my mailing list, I referred to the show Father Knows Best and how it was an example of what a perfect family would be. And coming from a very imperfect family, I loved watching this show. It was a sappy sitcom, but I loved watching it. It was like a vision of paradise for me. You know, dad and mom and the kids. And when, you know, his son was named Bud. And one of the kids was named Kathy. And I forget what the other one was. One of them had a nickname Princess. Anyhow, he had three kids. Two girls and one boy. And a lot of people, you know, I was an extreme case. You know, I had like a nightmare for a family. So I watched this as a vision of paradise, of what a family would be like. But I guess, you know, I wasn't the only one. On a continuum, millions and millions of other people, in this country were watching Father Knows Best and thinking of this man, you know, Jim Anderson, as the perfect father and husband. Turns out that the actor Robert Young, who was an A-level movie star in the late 30s and in the 40s. The show started, Father Knows Best TV show started in the 50s sometimes. Maybe then early to mid-50s it started, something like that. But he was a big movie star. I mean, he wasn't, a second rater. He was a big movie star. And not a bad actor, not a bad actor at all. I mean, he wasn't, you know, a tremendous actor, but he wasn't a bad actor. And he had starred in a lot of really serious movies, especially around World War II and afterwards. But like a lot of people, the movies went flat. The movies went strange and flat and boring, like a lot of things did in the 50s in this country. And there were, you know, and he got older. This is the facts of life. The man got older, and he, and there may be other personal reasons. It turned out, and I just found this out from sending out, a message about this to my mailing list, that poor Mr. Young, the actor who played this wonderful father and husband, the perfect father and husband, in real life, was an alcoholic and very depressed, and either, I can't tell from the emails I received, either attempted suicide or actually did commit suicide. So he was an alcoholic and depressed. And he may have had his personal reasons. There was a lot of actors who were very famous in the 30s and 40s, movie actors. And then when TV came along, they shrunk their acting talent and abilities to fit the small box, the small screen, and some of them were very successful at it. But the point being is that people, when they found out about Bill Cosby originally, and again, when you hear about it, you think, depending on how much you believe in the character and how much you confuse the character and the man who is playing the character. It's a real person who is an actor playing a character. But most of us, when we watch these TV series, we don't think that way. And I think depending on the extent that your life feels less real and less meaningful in your everyday life, and you watch these TV series, You want to believe in these people. You want to believe they're as good and as perfect as the way they act. So a lot of people were disappointed and angry, and they felt deceived about Bill Cosby. Many, many people felt deceived about Bill Cosby. But that's interesting all by itself. I mean, he is an actor, Bill Cosby. He is not Dr. Huxtable. And the other guy, maybe some people might remember the other guy, Robert Young, was not Jim Anderson, the insurance agent on Father Knows Best, nor was he later on the lovable Marcus Welby MD, which he played and was another big hit show. So he had a lot of success there, but the man was sad in his personal life, an alcoholic, And I have no idea how he treated other people. But here's Bill Cosby being accused of drugging and sexually assaulting, even you could use the word raping, various women. And there is testimony about this, and it's coming out, and it's affecting his career. His appearances on TV shows and other endorsements and other bookings he had have been canceled. Things have been canceled. And at the end of his, I shouldn't say the end of it, but near the golden age of his life, he's 77, things are going downhill for him now because he was living a kind of double life, like a secret life, which is the nature of actors. But they can get away with this because of the need. The reason that they're so successful, I mean, aside from the fact that these people can put on a great performance, you have to think about the actors. I mean, a lot of actors are bland and just not that talented. But if you take an actor who's very charismatic or can put on a really interesting performance and really, really project this lovable or perfect quality like Bill Cosby did, then what you have is millions and millions and millions, tens of millions of people who need to have somebody like that. So there's a complicity, a cooperation that's involved. It isn't just Bill Cosby putting something over on the American public. It's the American public putting something over on themselves or helping the whole process. So what you have is a kind of the performer or the character becomes a kind of a hologram of collective need and yearning and wish and desire, right? And that's part of the power of the theater and make believe. Good writing and good acting, you know, is necessary, but the audience has to be the willing participant. And then what they call it is suspending disbelief. Suspending disbelief. That's the word you always use. When you go to the theater, or you watch a TV show, or you watch a movie, or not necessarily when you read a book, but when you watch these things and you see characters pretending to be a certain type of person and things happen that don't seem real, like they would happen in real life, or they're too black and white, they're not complex, the endings are all sort of happy endings or sad endings, unless, of course, you get shows that are very complex and adult, you know, you get something like Breaking Bad, or you get something like you know, Mad Men, where it's sort of very much more like life, and then it becomes even more confusing, right? But what happens is, again, is that people bring their need, their desire, their suppressed lust, their suppressed greed, their suppressed, you know, their own lacks. You bring their own lacks. If you grew up in a family where, and let's face it, most families, we just went through Thanksgiving, right? And I say went through it. And I hope a lot of you had a good Thanksgiving. But, you know, it's tough, right? We talked about that on the last show. Most people grow up in families where things can be very, very rough and even worse, right? And to see something like Father Knows Best, to see this man, to see Dr. Huxtable, Bill Cosby, you know, and the way his family runs and the way he treats everybody, it brings out this collective wish to have a family like that, to have a father like that. Now, the character Don Draper in Mad Men, if you've seen Mad Men, who is himself, this is art within art within art within art within life. The character, the main character of Mad Men, I guess that ended a year ago or something like that, the series Mad Men, was himself a mystery to everybody else in the show. So you've got an actor named John Hamm. And if I say John Hamm, sometimes people will say, well, wait, John Hamm. No, his name was Donald Draper. His name is Don Draper. Don Draper is the character. So if I say the character, if I say Dr. Huxtable, it's realer to a lot of people than Bill Cosby, though in Bill Cosby's case, it's trickier because Bill Cosby has an entire career as Bill Cosby outside of the show, where he goes around and makes speeches and he does performances, you know, and he does comic stand-up comedy and performances and does commercials, and it's Bill Cosby, right? But in a lot of these shows, like a guy like James Gandolfini, who played, you know, Tony Soprano, or Robert Young, who was in Father Knows Best, and this guy John Hamm, who doesn't, you know, make a career out of doing anything else, or didn't, except playing Don Draper. You start thinking of these characters as these actors, as the character. So people say, well, Don Draper did this, or Dr. Huxtable did that, or Jim Anderson did that. And one thing that Don Draper said, and this is sort of what I'm talking about here, is he was talking about advertising. And he summed up what the appeal of Marilyn Monroe was once to some of the people who work with him. And he said, men want her, women want to be her. Men want her and women want to be her, which I thought was really a succinct, perfect summation. And because that's what advertising is a lot. Advertising is the trick of coming up with an image or an actor or something that's moving or that's in a newspaper or that's on a billboard or in a poster or something that pops up interminably like crazy, insane, overpropagated mice on your internet screen, you know, wherever you go. I mean, is there any content on the internet anymore or is it just all advertising? It's going to have to be that you look for the advertising, look for the content and try to get around the advertising. But that's what this guy, Don Draper, who was a genius advertising man on this show, Mad Men, said about Marilyn Monroe. Men want her, women want to be her. And the whole idea of advertising, just like propaganda, is to create images or to create situations or little dramas that appeal to people's needs or wants. And usually it's based on lacks, you know, that is to say, emptiness, holes in people's lives. You know, if you drive this car, you will be sexy and women will love you. So all these men on TV and driving these cars. And if you drive this car, if you smoke this cigarette, you will be very cool. You know, everybody will think that you're really cool. Or if you use this, or if you use that phone, or if you use this perfume, that you will be desired and beautiful by all men, this kind of thing. So, and the same thing applies for even, the same thing is transferable, this kind of combination of charismatic talent and an image, a powerful image that is projected by a person or, let's say, something created by an advertiser. Same goes for not just actors, but religious or political leaders. And, you know, even when, and the same thing also goes for, I mean, think of all religious and political leaders. They've got this tremendous dynamism, this tremendous charisma, and they project it. They project it, and what they're doing is, like in these mega churches, what they're doing is summarizing and embodying and describing for people in a passionate way what people can't articulate themselves, but that they feel so strongly. In other words, people who are struggling in their lives, who find life, whose lives feel like despairing or they need hope. Some pastor or some preacher comes along in one of these mega churches, one of these charismatic guys. I mean, you ever see Jimmy Swaggart? People like that. They run these giant mega churches, black and white, and they draw all these people. They draw all these people because these people want to believe. These people so desperately want to believe. And there was the movie they made of... and what they show every Easter is, I forget the title of it, but it's about Jesus and about his life and about his death. And it's cool. Maybe I think it's called Jesus of Nazareth. It's a really great movie, by the way. It's got all these wonderful actors in it, good writing. Franco Zeffirelli, a wonderful director, directed this movie. It was made in the 80s, and it's a terrific movie. You don't have to wait till Easter. There's no rule against watching it now, but it's really interesting. Of course, Jesus is played by a tall, blonde guy with blue eyes. But it doesn't make any difference. It's such a good movie, and the character is so good. And at one point, he runs across in his travels, he runs across a man named Thomas. And this man named this Thomas is very cynical and doubts everything that Jesus says. And he says to Thomas, he said, "The reason you doubt so much is because you want to believe so much." And that really grabbed me personally. That really grabbed me because I've always been sort of cynical and skeptical most of my life. And I think when the character said this, and it's doubting Thomas, right? And he said, "The reason you doubt so much is because you want to believe so much." And I think that really was true for me because I really felt that when he said it. So, but you know, this is how it works. Everything from Bill Cosby to a good actor to even con men. I mean, look at Bernie Madoff and look at Bill Clinton, Bernie Madoff, Bill Clinton, Ted Bundy. Let's throw in Adolf Hitler, right? Now, I'm sure a lot of people will find that very offensive. So what? I mean, I'm trying to make a point, you know? But all those guys like Clinton and Madoff and Bundy, they had this incredible charisma and charm, and they told people and what people desperately wanted to hear. You know, people wanted love. They wanted somebody to take care of them. They wanted somebody to notice them. You know, Clinton used to say, "I feel your pain." Yeah, I feel your pain. Pain in the ass, right? Pain in his ass, pain in my ass. He feels anybody's pain. I mean, we all felt his pain, finally, whether we wanted to or not. And we all felt Bernie Madoff's pain. But how do they get away with this all the time? And Clinton is still getting away with it. Clinton gets paid something like $1 million or $2 million to make a speech to the National Association of Weapons Manufacturers somewhere in Japan or in Bermuda. And then he comes back to the United States and says, "I feel your pain. We need to, you know, elect whoever it is that he's campaigning for because he's for the little man." And Clinton, the little man. And Clinton is just coming off a speech to, you know, the national, the International Global Terrorism Network production company or something or other. He doesn't care who he talks to. He's a prostitute. But all of these guys, these con men like Madoff and Bill Clinton and these serial killers like Ted Bundy, what they do is they bring out in people. People are all looking for love. They're looking for a father. I look at Bill Cosby. They're looking for the perfect husband. They're looking for somebody to give them some order in their chaotic and their anarchistic life. And then life in the United States can be so meaningless, so meaningless. I mean, tens of millions of people in the United States are living every day. They're living meaningless, empty lives. Even if they have a job, sometimes the job is demeaning. It doesn't give them any sense of pride. It doesn't give them any sense of having helped anybody or produced anything or added to the sum and content of human goodness. And that's the way life goes, right? I mean, you know, we've all had, I've had jobs like that, and a lot of us have had jobs like that. And what people have in their homes, they have all these material things which provide them no spiritual comfort whatsoever. And the more they get, the less spiritual comfort they have. So people have these very unspiritual, unmeaningful lives. And somebody comes along, like a passionate preacher or something like that, you know, or a con man. Look at Bernie Madoff. Bernie Madoff was giving people, what was it, 15% return? 15% return on their money. So a lot of people with lots of money and people with a whole lot of money gave their money to Bernie Madoff to be invested. And he was returning 15%. They never stopped to think, most of these people, and if they did, they just brushed it away because they didn't want to think about it. How is it possible that they got so much money? In a time when people were getting 1%, 2%, 3%, 4% on their money, and I have a listener who wrote to me, and his whole family was defrauded by Bernie Madoff, and they have virtually nothing, you know, and they're trying to scrape by. But they invested hundreds of thousands of dollars, which had been saved up over the years by the family and, you know, profits from small businesses and money that they made over decades, you know, over decades, and gave it to him and didn't question it. So what happens is all these people, in a way, you can't say it's a victimless crime, but it approaches a victimless crime. Like, a lot of people feel like Bill Cosby let them down terribly, you know, and almost like he committed a crime. Like he should somehow pay, not so much for the actual crimes he committed, which he may have committed, I should say. You know, it hasn't been proved in court. I mean, if he was giving, women all over the country for decades, if he was giving them drugs and then taking sexual advantage of them when they were drugged or maybe like unconscious, or maybe he was just being aggressive when they were drugged from drugs that he provided people. These are serious crimes for which he could spend the rest of his life in jail if they were ever proved. I don't know when the statute of limitations runs out on this. But the real crime that he committed, according to most people, is that he let people down. Everybody needed him to be Dr. Huxtable, but he wasn't Dr. Huxtable. It turns out that he was closer to Ted Bundy, you know what I mean? He didn't kill anybody, but he was... could have been. I don't know. I keep saying this. I should be qualifying all this because I don't want to accuse the man. And I certainly want to be sued for libel. Bill Cosby never did any of this until it's been proved that he did it. Okay. But if I ask you to raise your hand if you believe that he did do it, I'm sure you're right. I'm sure that absolutely everybody believes he did it. Now, that's maybe unfair and it's wrong, but that's how life goes. People, Marilyn Monroe, and you know, I don't. There's a whole continuum of these people. Some people don't deliberately try to take advantage of you. They don't deliberately try to take advantage of you. You know, actors get into trouble if they become famous portraying a certain kind of role. Now, Marilyn Monroe is always portraying the sexy, good girl who was making jokes and she would laugh a lot. She was a good time girl, especially earlier in her career. But she was always, obviously, as we all know now, extremely sad. She was an extremely sad, lost person who never really quite grew up. But because there were so many men, what did Don Draper say, the character in Mad Men? He said, men want her, women want to be her. Because she fulfilled the need of so many millions of people, they were willing to override whatever may have been wrong in her own life, right? People don't want to hear it. And I think the real crime that Bill Cosby committed, according to a lot of people, is that he may have done these things. And how could Dr. Huxtable do that? He's not Bill Cosby. He's Dr. Huxtable. How could he do this to us when we have invested all of our need and yearning and satisfaction for a father in this man? How could we do it? And it doesn't even matter how much you show it. If everybody proved, you know, every time they prove, you know, that some mega church leader turned out to be, you know, who condemns gays, turns out to be a homosexual, or that he stole, you know, $10 million from the church, even though he was telling people that she should be generous and contribute to everybody else, and he was living a selfless life. Every time that these things are proved, even then people don't believe it. They don't want to believe it because they're always looking for a reason to believe. The desire to believe is stronger than the facts that are presented to them.
If I listened long enough to you, I'd find a way to believe that it's all true. Knowing that you lie straight face while I cry, still I'd look to find a reason to believe. Someone like you makes it hard to live without somebody else. Someone like you makes it easy to give. Never think of myself. If I gave you time to change my mind, I'd find a way to leave the past behind. Knowing that you lied straight faced while I cried, still I'd look to find a reason to believe.
If I listened long enough to you, I'd find a way to believe it's all true. Knowing that you lie straight face while I cry, still I'd look to find a reason to believe.
Reason to believe, the need to believe, the need to suspend your disbelief in what is obviously a show or a theater performance, something that occurs on a stage that writers wrote somewhere in some back room someplace. Maybe crazy people who were drinking or who were cynical, writing the Dick Van Dyke Show. Comedy writers are notoriously weirdos, and speaking as somebody who is sort of in the same sort of ballpark as comedy writers, I mean they're notorious as neurotics, strange people who are depressed and sad and angry, but they write these wonderful bunny, Hallmark card shows. But usually these comedy writers are like cynical wise guys, smoking and drinking and making nasty jokes about the characters all the time. But they're the ones who turn out all these people, and movie script writers, very often the same thing. But reason to believe. People want a reason to believe. And that's what makes somebody like Cosby so disappointing to people, because he's not Dr. Huxtable. He's Bill Cosby, and he did all these things. And people would prefer it if Bill Cosby was as pure and as loving and as wonderful a husband and a father, in especially a man who treats women a certain way, in his personal life. And they are anything from, disappointed to angry and just betrayed by this. And it just brings them to tears when they think about something like this. But actors, generally speaking, an actor, this is kind of a shift here, but an actor, the usual protagonist in any kind of theatrical, like in a theatrical production, in a movie or in a book, any kind of artistic production, the usual protagonist is supposed to be sympathetic. It's very difficult to read a novel or to look at a TV series, which in a way is sort of extended like a long novel is. It's difficult to look at that and not feel some sense of identification. It's only in the modern world that things have become more complex and thus actually more realistic. Used to be that in 19th century novels or in some 20th century novels, early 20th century novels. But once the 20th century got moving along and you got into the 1920s, 30s, and even a little bit before that, when you had people like Henry James, what you have is that the main protagonist is not always so pure and not always good, whereas everybody else is bad. And that became something difficult to understand and to accept by a lot of people. But eventually, people did accept that and came to really admire it. And the reason was because it was more like real life. It was more like real life. And then TV comes along. TV was a kind of a throwback, in a way, to the old-fashioned black hat, white hat, old-fashioned good guy, bad guy thing. The only kind of faults that people like that Dr. Huxtable had is that occasionally he would get a little angry at somebody and later on he would apologize and everybody would say, oh, we love you anyhow, Dad. Or he would make a stupid mistake in terms of what the family needed. And later on he would say, oh, I was wrong. Same thing happened in Father Knows Best, Jim Anderson was always sort of getting things wrong a little bit. His wife was perfectly wise and calm and she knew the right answer to everything. She always had the right. She was centered all the time. She was emotionally centered. And her poor husband, sometimes he was just baffled by life itself and about what women wanted and what the kids wanted. But in the end, he came around, right? But this is TV. TV was a kind of this 50s TV, especially, and then later on, all the way, I guess, up until now. Are there shows like that now? that there are people that you can identify. I don't watch any modern series. You know, I see advertisements for them all the time. I see Mike and Molly. I see a million different kinds of shows. But I don't know if the and I'm guessing though. I'm guessing because of the needs, the general universal need of audiences to identify with somebody who, in the end, no matter how screw-uppy they are, you know, that they come around in the end and they are decent people. Seinfeld was weird because one of the main characters, if not the main character in a way, in a funny way, was Seinfeld, who was a cold, nasty guy. It was the other characters who were lovable and interesting. But Seinfeld was sort of like, he was, you know, like Jerry Seinfeld on stage playing Seinfeld with that cold, cynical, nasty attitude he had towards other people. He was not lovable. And so, but that's an old tradition, too, actually, that if you really could get, if you're really a tremendously talented writer, or like Shakespeare, for instance, you can do something like Richard III, which, by the way, House of Cards is based on. Richard III, Kevin Spacey was the artistic director of the Royal Shakespeare Company for at least a year, maybe longer, and always was a big admirer of Shakespeare. And, you know, the whole idea of, did you ever see House of Cards? The main character is such a vicious, cynical, immoral son of a bitch. It's astounding. It's hard to compare anybody you've ever seen to how awful this guy is. Capable of murder, of deception, of ruining people's lives, of driving people insane. And he gets a sadistic pleasure out of it. And one of the techniques is he's always talking to the audience. He'll say, well, she thinks or he thinks that they're going to have a good time now, that they're going to get away with it. But when I get through with them, there, you know, you watch and see what happens. I'm going to destroy these people for my own gain. And then he sort of smiles his evil smile. So that's another kind of protagonist is you look to see all the time. Is this, when is this guy going to crash? And the fact that he doesn't, that he goes on for season after season is really fascinating. But it all comes down to what. I guess it was it the Greeks or the maybe the Romans, what they called persona, the word persona. Cosby's persona was Dr. Huxtable on TV, and Cosby's persona in the Jell-O commercials and his stand-up comedy and his speeches about how to be moral to people all over. His persona is not just Dr. Huxtable, but it's Bill Cosby too. That's his persona. When you appear in public, just the way I am right now, if you put on a public face, you don't see my face, but you hear my voice and you imagine that I have a certain personality based on the way I'm talking. Maybe I don't have that same personality. Maybe I don't. I try, without getting into too many graphic or negative details, to tell you what my life is really like all the time. And one of the reasons I do it is selfish. One of the reasons I do it is so that I can, it's a kind of therapy for me. And also it feels good for me to know that so many people, by the way, I'd love for you to contact me, to know that people are listening and they may identify with something I say. They may actually even feel better about themselves or less alone because they hear somebody else say what I'm saying about themselves. But persona is a word which is derived from Latin, which is a Latin word, and it means a theatrical mask. Persona, like, you know, actors would get on stage in plays in Rome or wherever, you know, and they would put on, and this happened with Greek theater too, an actor was just an actor, a person. But if they wanted to be, you know, somebody else, so suddenly they wanted to be somebody evil, or they wanted to be the king, or they wanted to be a slave, or they wanted to be a revolutionary, or they wanted to be somebody who was a god, they would put on, literally put on a mask. They would hold a mask up to their face, or they would come out on the stage, or they would put on a mask and it'd enter from the wings and come out on stage. Persona is a theatrical mask. And that's what Dr. Huxtable was wearing. That's what that's what Bill Cosby is wearing, is a mask. It's a kind of a mask. Even somebody like me, and it gets very complicated, I have a persona. I am Mike Fader, the guy. My persona is Mike Fader, the guy on the radio who tells you how he really feels and explains what his life is really like. Is it really true? Well, certainly I'm not trying to deceive you, right? We all have our personae, you know, and I'm using the plural here. It's here's the literal translation. I wrote it down from Wikipedia. In the words, everyday usage is a social role, interesting, right, or a character played by an actor. And the word, again, is derived from Latin, where it originally referred to a theatrical mask. Think of that, a social role. In everyday life, in our relationships, in at the office where we work, wherever we have some interaction with other people, whatever we do, and generally is to have a functioning civilization and to keep things going, you can't act like a lunatic or a child or a psychotic. The people who don't put on a persona, and even then, the people who are crazy, and sometimes artists, you know, who do whatever they want or say whatever they want, or people who act crazy, even then it's a persona. People spend all their lives sometimes, if they're aware of this, trying to get to know who they really are. I mean, what is all the meditation and the therapy and the reflection and the philosophy? It's toward the goal of shedding or unlearning the layers of masks that have been placed on you by your family, by society, by peer pressure, roles that are imposed on us as we're growing up, or roles that you assume, psychological masks, persona that you assume, and then you become the person who helps everybody, or you become the person who needs help all the time. I mean, you develop a role, and everybody has this persona in their social lives. And you don't have to be a performer to have a persona. I mean, what do you bring to the office? You have to have a certain persona. You can't just express yourself any way you want, because the regular function of society just wouldn't work. I mean, but you do often, don't you often have the feeling that you've been cast in a play, that you've actually, and you never tried out for the role. You just, you grew up in a family, and then you get to be a teenager and you struggle with this. But then later on in your 20s and your 30s, and then later on when you get older, especially if you haven't thought about it that much, when you finally do stop to think about it, don't you get the feeling that you're in a play and you've been cast in a certain role to play this character? And it gets to be upsetting. A lot of times people have what they call midlife crises in their, maybe in their late 40s, in their 50s. Suddenly, because things may change in their lives, like when kids go away to college, there's something called the empty nest syndrome. All of a sudden, you don't get to play the role of a devoted mother who the kids need, and throw in also devoted wife to the husband, and this family. So a lot of families break up. There's a lot of divorces, and a lot of men and women suddenly start acting in ways that people don't even understand. Is that really Jim? Is that really Margaret? I can't believe that she's doing this or that he's doing this. And they were such a perfect couple, and now they're getting divorced. I'm mystified. I can't understand it, especially the kids. I mean, kids grow up, and unless they're sharp or unless they're aware, often they're taken by surprise by this, because some people try very hard, and they're good-hearted, and they're earnest, and they want to be a good family for their kids. But they haven't really maybe gotten along or felt that they were being fulfilled in their role personally, or they haven't gotten along or didn't feel that they really, really felt completely in love or in love at all with the person that they married. And people do change, of course. I mean, as you grow up through the decades, you change, and other people have trouble recognizing you. Unless you are aware of the fact of change, that life is change, and I'm definitely in one of those categories who never really understood that life is change. And often life is loss. You lose one thing and you change into something else. I can't say I really ever understood that. But persona is a mask, and we all wear these masks. And Imagine what it's like to be a spy. Did you ever read John le Carré's The Spy Who Came in from the Cold? Any good spy novelist, anybody who writes about spies, and sometimes the most perfect spies are people who do not understand themselves at all. So they are able to whip on a mask, a persona. They are able to whip on a mask and play the part. But the more they do it and the longer they do it, the longer they impersonate somebody as a spy, sometimes they lose themselves entirely and they have no idea and they can't even get back to where home is. You know, home is where you live. Home is where you live. The real you lives. And how many of us are really home? I don't really know. The idea is that, you are a certain person. And then again, that's what all this meditation and all this Buddhist meditation is about, all the different kinds of meditation. But especially my understanding of Buddhist meditation and certainly therapy is to get to know who you really are. To get to know who you really are and not to be playing a role, not to have just a persona. And imagine all the roles that people have to play in society. Imagine being gay, you know, throughout history. I mean, unless it was accepted in certain societies at certain times in history. But imagine being in America, for instance, and being gay in the 50s and the 60s and even later on, the 70s and the 80s. And then unless you live in a tiny, small world where your sexuality is accepted by people in this small little world. For a long time in New York City, it was had to do with ballet or decorators, you know, these old jokes. But it was true. People would stay with other people and try to avoid anybody, including their family, who would condemn them or do even worse, fire them, beat them up, you know. So it got so bad that, like, in the 50s, and if you watch Mad Men, it's interesting, too, because they have wonderful portrayals of that. They have men who are gay who are married. A lot of gay men, and I suppose the same with gay women, got married and had children because the persona of a man and the persona of a woman in society was that you had to sexually be, that you had to be heterosexual. That you had to get married, you had to be a father, you had to be a husband, you had to be a wife, you had to be a mother. And all of these persona that people had to play, and it just goes on and on and on. And marriages, you know, you meet somebody. I'm going to have some water, right? Okay, no, don't get concerned. I'm just having some water here. No. See at the top of the bottle? That's a great sound, isn't it? It sounds like mice. Anyhow, think of them. Are you married? Have you been married? Were you divorced? Have you been married twice? Have you been married three times? You had girlfriends, you had boyfriends, you had husband, you had a wife, or you have one now. How lucky you are. This is why people feel so good sometimes when they finally find somebody to mentor them in a program, or when they come across somebody like a monk who can guide them in their meditation, or a therapist who they can go to and who understands them. The idea that somebody finally gets you, you know, and you're so lost and you're so confused and you're so upset, you know that the situation you're in, whether it's a job and often if it's a relationship, you're in a marriage, you know it's not really you. You don't want to be there all the time. You don't want to be there. Now, sometimes that could be just pure childishness, a refusal to adjust to the reality that people aren't perfect and they're not always going to be perfect and that people change. So your husband or your wife may change or get older and have other needs and have other interests, or maybe they always had them and you just didn't know it. Or maybe they changed. And if you can't change along with them and still maintain that love, it's not necessarily that that it's not the real you and you're drifting away from them. It could actually be that you're just not adjusting to the realities of life. And believe me, I know whereof I speak. Change is not, as I've mentioned many, many times, change is not something that I've ever been very good at. I always wanted everything to stay the same. Somewhere there is a home. Somewhere there's a home. It's a place where you really live. And I think, if I remember correctly, some of these things from Buddhism was one phrase from Buddhism was, "What is your original face?" And a lot of times when I studied Tai Chi, they would talk about even the physical movements of Tai Chi. They would talk about trying to act like a child. Now, a child, and the same with Zen and the art of archery, they would say, let go of the bowstring the same way that a child lets go of something and moves on to something else. If you ever watch a little kid who who's fairly natural, when they are playing with some toy and they want to play with another toy, they drop the one toy and they move on to the other. They drop the toy and they just drop it. They don't necessarily throw it. They don't smash it down. They just drop it and move straight on to another toy. That effortlessness, that childlike effortlessness, is how the Zen archers try to teach you to let go of a bowstring. You don't pull it back and you don't aim it and you don't laser in on something. You just allow the arrow to point towards the target and then you let go of the string and the arrow goes where it needs to go. And I've always struggled with this. Like, what is my real self? What is my persona? Since it was always so distorted and since I had so many masks put on me and I had so many roles I had to play, I'm buried beneath all of them. And it's very difficult. And I know this goes to a certain extent for all of us, anybody who's listening. You had to assume a role. You had a persona. You had a role that you had to play. And it reminds me, I mean, my persona on the radio is even more confusing and complex because I'm the honest guy, right? I'm the guy who's telling you how I really feel in an attempt to try to understand myself. And yet with all the therapy I've had and all the radio shows I've done about trying to explore myself, I still feel often confused and like I'm wandering in a foreign country when I'm with other people. Because I still don't really understand who I really am. I'm still performing in a way, I guess. And I always say, when I've been in therapy and when I'm on the radio, I try not to perform, even though I have a responsibility to be entertaining or to be passionate about things because you're listening to me. I try, as I go along, not to perform, but just to talk and try to see if I can surprise the real self in me. Then I can just sort of calmly come across the real self. I mean, an indication of how my persona is not exactly something that I've really that I've thrown off and discovered my real self is that I often feel more real on the radio. I feel more real on the radio than I do in real life. And let me just end with a quote from T.S. Eliot, part of a poem. He says, "We shall not cease from exploration, and at the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time." Think about that. It's like Dorothy said, there's no place like home.